I'm from New Jersey. I don't expect too much. If the world ended today, I would adjust. I'm from New Jersey. No, I don't talk that way. I watch too much TV when I was young.
Coming to you from the radio studios at Montclair State University, this is The News in Jersey, the weekly podcast of the NJ News Commons. I'm Debbie Gallant.
And I'm Mary Mann.
Today we're discussing the upcoming one-year anniversary of Superstorm Sandy. The storm, which struck on October 29, 2012, rocked New Jersey, causing billions in damage, killing dozens, displacing thousands, and making New Jersey rethink how and where we should rebuild.
Our guests include Paul Goldfinger, who calls himself a heart specialist posing as a journalist. Paul writes Blogfinger, a news and opinion website based in and about Ocean Grove, New Jersey. We also have Scott Gorian joining us. Scott is covering the Sandy Beat for both NJ Spotlight and New Jersey Public Radio through a grant from the New Jersey Recovery Fund. And we have Mark Diano, columnist for the Star Ledger, who's been on the Sandy Beat all year.
Welcome, everybody. Let's start with Scott. Scott, you covered the storm last year and have reconnected with some of the folks you talked to in the immediate aftermath. At a personal level, what do you see a year later?
Well, and it is very much on a personal level because you have a lot of anecdotes, but it's hard to get a sense of the big picture because you try to find data and, you know, you look, for example, at try to find building permits. But, you know, it's hard to know whether this new if there's new construction, if it's because of, you know, rebuilding because of the storm or if this would have happened anyway because of the housing recovery. Or, you know, we know there are some things we do know. We know summer tourism figures are way down. I read a figure just the other day in Ocean County alone. The county planning board estimated that 26,000 people are still not back in their homes a year later. But it's unclear how many of those are primary residences versus, you know, how many are shore homes. And there's just not that data available that I've been able to find on a statewide level. So I have been, you know, spending the last few weeks trying to check back in with many of these people that I'd interviewed a year ago. We're trying to make kind of this interactive map on our website for New Jersey Spotlight to follow up with these people, see where they are 1 year in. And the picture is kind of mixed. I mean, on the one hand, there are some people like, you know, people who weren't hit incredibly bad in the first place. Two women who I had met, you know, on the streets of Belmar, who I managed to track down. One woman she had been looking for a job for months after the storm and kind of her boyfriend's house right along the shore was all flooded. And then she got this wonderful job the week after, is doing really well. This other woman who's her friend was you know, saw the whole storm as a chance to, you know, she kind of rethought everything about life, how lucky she was. She wasn't hit as bad as many of her neighbors. And she started this new business making handmade jewelry. And she's really happy with everything right now. And of course, in Sayreville, I've gone back to there to re-interview several of the people I interviewed. And many of these people are getting buyouts now. So it's kind of bittersweet that, you know, it's sad to kind of leave their homes. But on the other hand, they're happy to move on. And, you know, are they getting as much money as they'd like? No. But they, you know, they feel for their own safety, for their well-being, for their families, they'd like to move to somewhere else. So they're happy about that. On the other hand, there are people like in Seaside Heights. I've tracked down some of the people I'd interviewed there. This guy and his wife, who I actually met them the first day that they were allowed back on the island to just kind of assess the damage and collect whatever personal belongings they could fit in two suitcases. I checked back in with them now, and their house basically was over 50% damaged. It was one of these little bungalows, or I guess it was technically slightly larger than a bungalow, but it was pretty tiny. And you know, because it was over 50% damaged, they would have had to rebuild it to comply with all the new building codes, FEMA regulations, raise up the building. And because it was so small on such a small lot, they just wouldn't have been able to do that. So they had to level it. They had to bulldoze it. It's now an empty lot. This guy's still living on the other side of the bridge in Toms River, trying to, you know, waiting for some aid money to rebuild. Meanwhile, his wife, who I had met, started having all these seizures, which he thinks are, he can't prove it, but he thinks they're related to all the stress they've been going through. A lot of people in really bad situations still.
I'm going to jump to Mark because he's a columnist and often focuses on individual stories. So, Mark, tell us some of those stories, and particularly a year later, what are you finding?
Well, I pretty much concur with all that. You know, there's people in vastly different circumstances. I guess the thing that I find a year later is the enormous resilience of people and the ability to bounce back. You know, you have people like the Gelhouses at the Kingsburg Amusement Park who were absolutely devastated, destroyed by the storm, and reopened by Easter. You have Gigi Doer from Jacobot's in Ocean Beach, whose business was destroyed. And she opened up a couple blocks away before the summer using doors from the neighbors' homes that were destroyed as tabletops, you know, sort of to pay homage to the despair of her neighbors. So I see a lot of resilience in that way. And to me, the big issue is that you still have people of modest means who have second homes that can't get back in, and until they get back in, the economy of the shore will not repair. And on the inland parts of the bay, Toms River in particular, in Bricktown, you have people of modest means who can't figure out whether they want to rebuild or not, if they should elevate, what it's going to cost to elevate, the risks if they don't elevate. And so a year later, there's still so many questions that remain to be answered. You know, FEMA elevation, the likelihood of such a hurricane happening again, and what's going to happen to neighborhoods. You know, some people aren't rebuilding until they can get a sense of what their neighbors are doing. You don't want to improve a house that's not going to be you know, in a desirable location if everyone else packs out or lets their houses just fall, go to pieces.
I want to go to Paul right now. I know you have a very specific situation in Ocean Grove. Can you talk about the damage there? But I think more specifically the issue is how to secure FEMA funds and the situation.
Right. Well, relatively speaking, we're not doing so bad in Ocean Grove. Most of the houses survived the storm. The big damage was to the oceanfront, to the beach, and especially the boardwalk. The boardwalk was destroyed. And Ocean Grove is more of an interesting sandy story than one of real suffering. But what's interesting about it stems from the fact that Ocean Grove is a very unique town. It was founded by Methodists and for over 100 years was run by a religious organization called the Camp Meeting Association. So fast forward to now, all the land in town is owned by the Camp Meeting Association. And the boardwalk and the entire beachfront and even part of the ocean, it seems, is owned by them. So when it came time for us to rebuild our boardwalk, which is a very important component of our town in so many ways, FEMA rejected our application, and we became the only town that I know of among all our neighbors, such as Asbury Park and Belmar and Spring Lake and Bradley Beach. All our neighbors were promised money from FEMA, and we were turned down. And the reason we were turned down, we feel, is a technicality, but it's a really fascinating story of a small town wrestling with a big federal bureaucracy, and we have, in fact, been wrestling. There are politicians involved. It's quite a fascinating situation. The turn down was appealed once, and it was declined. And now the Camp Meeting Association, backed up by our local legislators and backed up by the governor's office, are going for a second appeal. And they will be meeting in Washington with FEMA officials to try to get them to look at our situation in a different way. The fact is the boardwalk is still destroyed. It affected the lifestyle in Ocean Grove. It affected our businesses, and it affected potentially safety, medical care, and other aspects of what's offered from a boardwalk. And it caused us to reevaluate what is a boardwalk and what is it for and what does it do. And we found out a lot about ourselves in the process.
I was just going to say, speaking of Washington and the federal government, has the shutdown of the last 2 weeks affected the story at all?
I'll say, I mean, it has been hard to get information. And obviously all of us journalists are kind of trying to scramble for the one-year anniversary, trying to get, you know, tabulations of how much aid has been handed out so far.
Is FEMA up and running? Is FEMA's website up and running?
that's tricky. The website, there are, if you go to the FEMA's website now and you try to get info on aid or whatever, there are notices at the top of the website, like there are, I think, on most federal websites now, saying that, you know, certain information may not be updated. They have their, you know, daily, they have this little widget on their website that lists the amount of aid that's been handed out to date, and they used to update it at the end of every day, and that hasn't been updated now in several weeks. So some of that is behind. The good news for Sandy survivors is that the aid portion of, you know, FEMA's operation is still operating. Anyone who has kind of an open claim,
it's considered essential, so they get to continue.
It's essential, so yeah, and there, that part of, you know, the aid budget for FEMA is separate from it, the rest of its budget, so mm-hmm. that is still operating, and if people call up the hotline, they will still be able to reach someone.
But, you know, before we started, Scott, you were talking to us about the government transparency issues generally and about the difficulties journalists have in finding things out. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. Well, the biggest problems I've encountered have been on the state level, this issue of transparency that, you know, I think a lot of journalists are aware of this problem because they've encountered it firsthand, but they haven't really seen too much coverage of it. Just getting very basic information. I mean, you've basically got two guys who run the governor's press office. Their job is supposed to be to communicate with journalists, but they have a receptionist who screens their calls every time you try to get information. If they don't like you or your news outlet, like I don't think they particularly like me. Well, I never get a call back or a response to my emails. And the important thing is also, it's not just the governor's office, it's the governor's press office also handles media requests for the Office of Recovery and Rebuilding, which is overseeing the whole Sandy recovery process. The guy who's the head of that office, Mark Frazan, the so-called storm czar, he very rarely makes public appearances, since he assumed that position last November. He's made very few public appearances, never speaks to the media. It just feels like pulling teeth sometimes to get very basic information.
Scott, I find that particularly galling myself, we have a storm czar, and this guy was supposed to be the font of all knowledge on the storm and the recovery, and I don't think I've ever seen him quoted, you know, let alone in public. I don't even remember seeing him quoted in a news story, and I've made attempts to try to interview him and talk to him about some issues, and there is really this arm's length. You know, the governor's been very good, I think, showing leadership, you know, showing up at the disaster and giving people, and you know, like him or not, he brings comfort, you know. People like to see his face out there. I traveled, with him, walked the boardwalk a couple of times during the Seaside Heights fire, and the way people are drawn to him and take some solace in his presence, and he's been very good to Seaside. But there are so many places, including the urban areas, Munaki, the Ironbound section of North, that haven't gotten any of the attention of the shore, and I don't get any indication that the storms are cares about those people at all.
So, Paul, how are you feeling about the Christie administration's response in Ocean Grove?
Well, let me just first say that I've been disappointed in the media coverage of Ocean Grove. It seems like the media has a certain narrative that they want to portray about this, how successful New Jersey's been with dealing with Sandy. But there are some have-nots, including Ocean Grove. And when they do write about Ocean Grove, they frequently get the facts wrong, because in order to understand what happened to our town, they got to dig into the FEMA regulations and the small points that have made the difference between our getting funding and not, technicalities. And they often get the story wrong. So I'm busy on my little blog trying to explain it as it really is. But the governor, we're told by the Camp Meeting Association that the governor's office is very active in trying to help us, and that our congressman, Chris Smith, is very active in helping us. And neither of them have come to Ocean Grove to walk our, I call it the grassy sandy strip, because there is no boardwalk there. And so we haven't seen him in Ocean Grove, just a lot of talk about what he's doing, and we haven't seen our congressman, Chris Smith, either.
Paul, I'm surprised when you talk about the media getting it wrong. You're part of the media. That's one of the things we're all about at the NJ News Commons. Mark Diano of the Star-Ledger can only get so many places.
Well, I'm just sorry to disagree, Paul, but I wrote a column about Ocean Grove, which I think had it right. It was about the decision, the FEMA decision, which had nothing to do with religion. It had to do with a sort of an absurd reasoning that the boardwalk there was strictly recreational, which really applies to every boardwalk in New Jersey. So I was down in Ocean Grove and met with the guys from the CAM Meeting Association and went out and did a column explaining, the skewed reasoning of FEMA. So I'm not sure exactly that all the media's got it wrong.
Oh, I don't think I said all media. I just said I've been disappointed how often they get it wrong, and it's what you just said. You're tuned in, obviously, to that small point that makes it such a huge difference for us, and I'm not going to discuss it now, but it is a point that requires some effort on the part of reporters to get it right, and a lot of them didn't get it right. I must say NJ.com has done a great job in this respect. Because I noticed your offices as I was walking in here, one of the offices at NJ.com, and I've been admiring their reporting for Ocean Grove. I know that's a Star-Ledger media, right?
It's interesting. Website. Yes, there's the related. It gets complicated. Their Facebook status is complicated over at Advanced Publications. But I think Ocean Grove proves the point of how complicated Sandy coverage is. I think, Scott, you were saying when you got this gig to do the recovery fund and cover Sandy for Spotlight and NJPR, people were like, oh, are you going to have enough stories? There are endless stories, and they're of myriad different types. Each town has different intricacies involved, and the personal stories vary.
It all comes down to our form of government and home rule with 565 municipalities. There's so many different rules and situations that it's really hard to paint with a broad brush.
Well, we were looking at the Sandy anniversary coming up at the end of the month, and we put out a call to the NJ News Commons partners to say, you know, what is your special anniversary coverage? We haven't gotten a lot of response, but what we were thinking is that the coverage of Sandy has been unending. I mean, I don't know. Or we were also wondering, is it just that the coverage is so high, or is there Sandy coverage fatigue? I don't know. What do you think, Scott? Do you think?
I mean, I could understand that it's been such a big issue for so long. I could understand. I mean, I've spoken to some people who say, you know, when they hear stories that come on, you know, WNYC, they just kind of change the station.
Oh,
when,
really?
You know, and it's frustrating because, you know, to people in these situations, they want their stories told. They, you know, people are still struggling. They want to make sure people don't forget, especially, you know, if you go down, you know, to Manhattan or somewhere inland, you know, Essex County, parts of Essex County, you know, obviously Newark, Ironbound, some sections were really badly affected. But, you know, people who aren't right at the shore, I think might, you know, forget that this is an ongoing issue, that many people are still suffering. So I think it's really important that we continue to cover this, and also because this is taxpayer money that's going to fund much of this recovery, and this is our, you know, dollars out of our pocketbook, so we need to know what's happening.
I was absolutely floored in the beginning of the summer when people would go down to the Barrier Island, and that's the island just between Point Pleasant and the state park, the Northern Barrier Island, not LBI, and would come back and say, oh, I had no idea it was that bad down there.
Oh.
You got to be kidding me. You know, so for many people, once they got their electricity back, the storm was over. I think the media in general, and I include myself in this, has been very bad about covering the non-shore areas. They have gotten the most attention. They generate the most revenue. And obviously the most, the storm porn, the pictures of the most of the greatest devastation is really down there. The houses knocked off the foundations and thrown around like Monopoly pieces. That's at the shore. We haven't done such a great job with the urban areas or some of the issues of the Raritan Bay flooding. Union Beach certainly got a lot of attention, but Keensburg, for instance, did not. And it's been kind of scattershot. Some of it has to do with where the governor visits. Some of it has to do with how good a town is at promoting itself. Some of it has to do with what churches adopted a town and the media coverage that caused that. So for me, the anniversary is a date that comes and goes, but the storm and the impact on the state is continuing. Just as an example, only now are we beginning to see, to get a full understanding of the amount, and Scott alluded to this earlier, the amount of people that are walking away from their properties that have run the insurance and FEMA gamut, and they're just giving up. They're going to walk away. So the foreclosure rate is going to climb. The tax bases are going to shrink. What happens to sections of these towns that are reliant on all that, that money, that income dries up? You're going to have, the state has a program to get people to repopulate. You know, there are grants for repopulation, but there's no money for people to repair their second homes so that they can enjoy them again and pump money into the shore economy. I think the real estate effect of this is going to be a 10-year process, and I'm not an economist or an expert. I'm just a guy in the newspaper, but it looks to me like we're a long way from a full recovery.
Let me ask a political question. You could say this terrible event really elevated Christie, right? He became a national figure and a national folk hero. Can we talk a little bit about how the storm has affected his career?
I'll start, if you don't mind. You know, like I said earlier, whether you like him or hate him or love him or dislike him, however you want to couch it, he's out there, and he's sincere. I've seen him off camera with people. He seems to really he connects with people in ways politicians rarely do. He knows a lot about individual situations and people. I've seen him on the boardwalk the day after, 2 days after the storm in Seaside. I've seen him at the fire and other places. And this, he has this incredible ability to make people think that he really cares, and I think he does.
But is that important? If you show up for photo ops, somebody could say, or you show this personal charisma, doesn't it get down to how you administer, how you respond to people's claims, how your storms are is functioning, and the transparency of your government? Isn't that more important?
Well, I don't know, because there's the money side and then there's the human side, and I wouldn't dismiss the governor's appearances as at the shore as photo ops. On the night of the fire, the guy walked up and down those neighborhoods away from the cameras. It was a sweltering night. There's smoke in the air. I wrote a column about it. You know, his pants, he was drenched. His suit pants were frayed.
But nobody's doubting he's sincere. Oprah would be sincere if she were walking the boardwalk after a fire. The question is, would she be a good governor? So the question is he doing a good job in terms of the money and the accountability issues of what needs to be done? And also, this could launch him into the presidency of the United States.
I think our recovery has been kind of amazing. There's still a lot of pockets of destructed areas and people still out of their houses. But, you know, we had electricity and gas, water back on the barrier islands within 3 or 4 weeks of the storm. A lot of homeowners were able to get back in. There are all sorts of demolition projects that have gone on. I know my paper criticized the no-bid contract on the removal of debris, but seeing that amount of debris disappear as quickly as it did, I mean, mountains of stuff just gone within a month, was really amazing. To see boardwalks like Belmar and Seaside be open for the season after that devastation was pretty damn good. I think the recovery, and it's not just the governor's office, it's the county's OEMs and private investment and all sorts of stuff. I think I've covered this storm as well as anybody, and have been in more locations of destruction than most people. And I think the recovery is miraculous. I'm not going to be critical of it.
Just to add, onto what Mark's saying and to clarify what I was saying before, I mean, destruction from Sandy. It was the second most destructive hurricane or in dollar figures ever after Katrina. So it's a gargantuan task to try to start rebuilding all this. So in light of that, I mean, you know, you look at where we are a year versus a year ago, there certainly has been a lot of progress there, for people who are still suffering. It's never going to be enough, obviously, and there's still a long way to go. I think it's just about a quarter of the total, you know, federal aid money coming to New Jersey. It's been handed out so far, has been given out to date. So there's still a lot more to go. Just to clarify what I was saying a little earlier, I wasn't necessarily saying that the governor is doing a bad job at all. I was just saying, you know, I imagine they are doing a lot of hard work behind the scenes. And I just think it would be to their benefit to be more public and open with what exactly is going on behind the scenes.
To pivot a little bit here, how much are we considering the bigger picture of building so close to the water? Scott, I know you and I both saw that documentary, Shored Up, which really gets into it. How well are we telling that story as journalists?
Obviously, these are important issues. We're using all this tax money, you know, to rebuild. We don't want to rebuild somewhere where something will just get washed away by the next storm. We want to make sure people are safe, not just for the next year or two, but kind of over the long term. And you look at, you know, predictions of sea level rise, climate change, and you know that these are going to be issues more and more in the future, not just, you know, the potential for more severe storms, but even just, you know, sea level rising. And you know, these are barrier islands. Many of these places, they naturally shift over time. It's hard to just kind of have this property, set your square footage, and know that the ocean's always going to be where it is now, because it's not going to be. We know that for a fact. So looking ahead, you know, and I'm starting to look into this now, really, the only kind of main requirements here in New Jersey that we're putting into effect are, you know, complying with the FEMA flood maps plus one additional foot that people whose homes were destroyed over 50%, if they're rebuilding, they're going to have to raise up their homes to comply with these new maps if they're near the water's edge, and especially in areas where there's risk of waves hitting and severe destruction. Beyond that, there's not a lot of other regulations in New Jersey versus, you know, you look at some other states, Maryland, North Carolina, you know, a lot of these states have plans in place looking at sea level rise, climate change, planning, you know, all of their rebuilding for 2100, 2050, you know,
right,
looking
well, the
out
Christie
in the
administration
future.
Has not embraced climate change, basically. I mean, do you think that's a part of it? Or?
Oh, well, that's certainly part of it. And I think there's also, you know, at least so far anyway, the focus has been on kind of getting people back up and running, rebuilding, right, without focusing as much on the longer term, just more on the shorter term.
You look at
term.
The buyouts happening in New York City and neighborhoods there that will no longer be neighborhoods. But I don't think they represent the portion of the economy when you look at the Jersey Shore. I often hear the number that that's the third largest industry.
Bingo.
The third largest industry in New Jersey is tourism, and that's mostly centered around the shore.
That's why we can't just give it up, right?
To answer the question, are we looking at the big picture? The answer is no.
What is the shortest answer you've ever given, Mark?
we're rebuilding exactly where what was left, what was destroyed. We're going exactly where we were. We're going to put everything up a little higher. And my understanding is that the new FEMA elevations do not take into account the scientific evidence of rising sea level.
Scott and Mark, really quickly, what about the press's role in bringing the role of global warming and the really long term to the public's attention?
Well, I mean, part of the way I'm covering it, again, is just to kind of look at, well, what is New Jersey's approach versus other states, other places? And is, you know, my job as a journalist isn't necessarily to say, you know, this is the right approach, or that, you know, just to lay out the information for people, say, and this is what the scientists say, this is what our state is doing, this is what New York City is doing, and look at kind of what is the best approach going forward.
I guess you have to say, what is your own, I'm a columnist, what is my own philosophy on this? What do I believe? What is my responsibility to bring it, my beliefs, to the public attention? And the way I look at it is pretty simple. What we have, we can sustain for a long, long time if we build intelligently. We're not going to just walk away from those islands. We never will. They generate too much money, and you know, they're there for our enjoyment. You know, we've made it that way, that they're there for our enjoyment. You can't just pull up stakes and say, well, barrier islands are going to be barrier islands, and they're going to revert to what North Carolina has. It's just not going to happen. And so, you know, my view has been as a journalist to try to tell the human side of the stories and at the same time acknowledge the reality of the situation. We are entrenched. The Jersey Shore is part of our DNA. We're not going to walk away from it. And just even looking at neighborhoods like in Sayreville and Woodbridge, where people are getting buyouts and it's being returned to Blue Acres, these are heartbreaking situations for these people. No one's taking any great joy in having to abandon these shore areas or wetland areas. So I guess I'm waffling on the question, but I just think you have to, you know, write what you see and what you know from your heart and go from there.
Well, that's it for this week's News in New Jersey. Thanks to our guest, Scott Gorian, here for NJPR and NJ Spotlight, Paul Goldfinger of Blogfinger in Ocean Grove, and Mark Diano of the Star-Ledger. And before we thank our engineer, Adam Goldberg, and singer-songwriter John Gorka for taking us out, I'd like to extend an invitation to others in the News Commons to write us and to let us know what your plans are and what your thoughts are on this Sandy anniversary.
And you can write us at info@njnewscommons.org.
I'm from New Jersey. I don't expect too much. If the world ended today, I would adjust. I'm from New Jersey. No, I don't talk that way. I watch too much TV when I was young.